past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. Remember, visit jackandrea.com. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is not just Monday, but also the day after Mother's Day. And it seems really appropriate indeed on today's morning show for me to be reconnecting with a wonderful writer by the name of Fern Schumer Chapman. I first had the pleasure of speaking with Fern Schumer Chapman when a marvelous memoir of hers called Motherland, Beyond the Holocaust, A Mother-Daughter Journey to Reclaim the Past, was chosen as a book for, I'm trying to remember, I think it was the city of Racine, but I'm not sure, certain if it was Racine, it was Racine. So for the Racine Reads Project, this book was selected, and all kinds of readers, hundreds, young and old alike, in a sense, read this book together or read it simultaneously and came together to discuss it. And I had such a pleasant conversation, an illuminating conversation with Fern Schumer Chapman about that book and about at least one of the books which have come since. She's written several. And today we are also going to be talking about a brand new book that she has written, which is a lovely children's book called Happy Harper Thursdays, A Grandmother's Love for Her Granddaughter During the Coronavirus, a book which she wrote in large measure to help youngsters maybe come to better understand just what this whole matter of social distancing is all about and why it necessitates, among other things, us not being able to be together with some of the people that we love the most in our lives. And I'm very, very pleased that we can talk with its author about it and also about kind of the whole experience of this time of social distancing and what it has been like for her as a writer to try to continue to function and create when so much of the world at the moment just seems kind of turned upside down. Fern Schumer Chapman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be here.
I really am happy for this opportunity. Maybe we could just begin with that kind of general conversation about what it is like for you as a writer. In some respects, it sort of feels like a scenario where you still have your desk and you still have your word processor or your pen and paper or whatever it is, the sort of immediate tools with which you write, and yet I'm guessing that it feels very different to be writing and creating right now. What has this facet of this experience been like for you, at least thus far?
Well, I actually have joked about the fact that my life in general is largely socially distanced because I spend a lot of time writing in my office. But that's probably 60% of my life, and the rest of it is speaking and engaging with readers. And of course, I've completely lost that. So typically in the spring, I give a lot of school presentations, and my mother, who's 85, continues to go with me to these events, and so we have lost all of those opportunities. There's a lot that happens at those speeches, aside from the fact that these students learn so much about the Holocaust history and being an unaccompanied minor, and we can talk more about those books in a few minutes. But also I get a lot of feedback and I understand then more about what students are thinking about and what matters to them. So during this time, I actually changed focus and I started to think about what really mattered to me. So I think that Happy Harper Thursdays is the result of what was hurting me at that moment. And what is not being discussed all that much is how social distancing and shelter in place restrictions are affecting grandparents.
I'm really glad that you said that because I think you are right. That is kind of an unanticipated or maybe not fully understood consequence of all of this. Before we dig into that just a little bit further, that is intriguing to think about how in some respects one facet of your life is different and another facet is in a sense scarcely changed at all in terms of kind of the mechanics of what a day looks like when you are devoting yourself to writing. I wonder if, I hope this isn't too personal a question, but I know from talking to certain creative people, and I count myself among them, various people feel like their creative process feels actually quite different right now in terms of maybe capacity to focus or trying to keep certain stresses or fears at bay. Do you find yourself contending with any of that when it comes to the actual matter of writing itself?
Well, I think there's a certain stuckness. There's this feeling that you can't get out of your place and your mind's place as well. So I think that creates a challenge as far as how I'll move forward and who's reading and does this matter anymore? And I think that's kind of the frustration of being a creative person. Everything on the in the outside world feels like it's changed. And what matters anymore? And so that creates a real block in terms of what can I write and what can I do that has resonance today?
I think that's very well put. I find myself, I once upon a time was a very prolific blogger. For various reasons, that's a little less part of my life now than it used to be, but I haven't blogged a single word since all of this started, and I feel like part of it is, I feel like we're part of something that's really big and really complex, and I find myself feeling very intimidated by trying to set down words that would somehow convey something meaningful. I mean, I could probably write about what this means for me, but it feels like one of those situations that calls for a lot more wisdom than I have to bring to some, you know, very kind of complex and also some really kind of troubling or disconcerting questions.
I think the second part piece of it is concentration. And it is very difficult to concentrate given the larger events in the world. And I know, I've talked to readers as well, and a lot of people have told me that they don't have the concentration to read. So that contributes to the problem as well. If they don't have the concentration to read and I'm not, and I'm struggling with the concentration to write, where are we?
We're not where we used to be. That's for sure. Yeah. That's for sure. As we mentioned in the introduction, part of what we are talking about today is this brand new book that you have written, a children's book called Happy Harper Thursdays, A Grandmother's Love for Her Granddaughter During the Coronavirus. I'm curious, first of all, at what point in all of this did you begin to think seriously about crafting some kind of book like this, or maybe not like this, to speak to the situation? I mean, like from day one, were you already thinking about this?
Well, I had this thought on the first day of shelter in place restrictions, which was somebody's going to actually do something that resonates and has value. And what could I do that would have a unique contribution. And so on that first day, I thought a lot about how one of the most painful aspects of the changes in my life is that I don't get to see my granddaughter Harper every Thursday. And then I started to think about how this would seem to a very small child. It's very confusing that they suddenly lose this constant presence in their lives. And so I decided on that day I really wanted to do something to help her understand why this was happening. And I didn't want her to misinterpret this in some very uncomfortable and painful way.
Right. So, for instance, you want to make sure that she doesn't think you have lost interest in her, or that you are scared of her or angry with her. I suppose there are any number of things that a young child might mistakenly use to fill in the blank of why isn't my grandmother visiting, or why won't she let me visit her?
Well, anybody who has explored psychology of children knows that they often misperceive situations. They often blame themselves for something that happens. And I was so afraid that Harper might think about, and she's very young, but she might, other and other children might think that maybe my grandmother isn't coming around anymore because she doesn't love me. Now, the reason I'm very familiar with this particular reaction, as you know, is I've been writing about my mother's story. She was an unaccompanied minor when she was only 12 years old. She left Nazi Germany for America in 1938. And the way she interpreted her parents' very painful decision to send her away is that she carried this sadness her whole life. And the sadness was that maybe they didn't love her. So she was stuck in a 12-year-old's broken heart. And I'm very sensitive to family separation issues because of my mother's very painful psychology and reaction to her parents' choice. So that was the foundation for this book.
Hmm. Tell us a little bit about how you went about crafting the story and shaping it, and also finding the words with which to convey this story. And one of the reasons I'm taking pains to ask this question is because I think way too many people, and I'm probably one of them, make very blithe assumptions about the ease with which the typical children's picture book takes shape, because it doesn't seem nearly as complicated an undertaking. And I suppose in some ways it probably isn't as complicated an undertaking as the crafting of a novel or a long, intricate memoir. And yet, it does not write itself, and I think it does a great children's book a real disservice to assume that it's kind of a very easy thing to write. So I hope you don't mind taking us really inside the process by which this book took shape and the kinds of things you sort of weighed along the way.
Well, first of all, you're right. The process of writing this kind of book is very different from writing a memoir. And one of the things that I became extremely aware of while writing Happy Harper Thursdays is that every word has to count. You cannot waste words. So it's almost like a little powerhouse. You know, you have to have everyone advancing the story. The book starts out with me talking about our routine, which is every Thursday, we have Happy Harper Thursdays. And obviously, the writing of it has to make sense to a very small child. So how do you explain coronavirus to a small child? Well, you have to create an image. And my image was a meanie bug. And this idea that this meanie bug is so contagious, and of course you can't use that word, but from moms to dads and grandparents to grandchildren, and that nobody knows how to make it go away. So The thinking really was, how can I simplify this so that a child can understand? And the book really captures the Thursdays and what we typically do on a Thursday. And then, of course, what will happen when we're separated and how I'm going to feel and how she will feel. And so I really wanted the book to be very emotional and for the small child to get a glimpse that you're going to feel really sad about this because you are separated from people you love. But that doesn't mean that they don't love you. And that was the premise that I wanted to communicate to small children. And what I've discovered since it's come out, which was just a few weeks ago, is grandparents are hurting. And they are buying this book because they want to Zoom read it with their grandchildren so that the child gets an understanding of why they're not there every week now.
You just touched on something that I think we haven't, I don't remember if we've talked about it in the conversation yet or if this was before we began, but the fact that not enough of us understand sort of the special pain being experienced by grandparents right now, because of course the typical parents are in a sense sequestered with their children day and night all week long. And grandparents are left in a very, very different situation. It couldn't be more different. And I don't think that's being talked about very much.
Well, I agree. And I know that from the grandparents I've spoken to and heard from as a result of the book, that they deeply identify with this. Particularly the grandparents who have had the great pleasure and opportunity of seeing their children routinely. Suddenly there are no cuddles, there are no hugs, and yes, there's FaceTime, but it's a very poor substitute when you're the grandparent of small children. And as a result, it's left the grandparents bereft. And of course, I think to some extent the grandchildren as well. But I know that I carry around this chronic ache because I don't get to see my granddaughter. And that's not going to change anytime soon. And so it's extremely painful. Complicating my situation is the fact that my son and daughter-in-law are in the health fields. And so I can't imagine that I'm going to be able to see my granddaughter very soon because any of them could be carriers.
Mm. So in other words, there is a higher risk in this particular scenario than for a lot of other people.
Right. And you know, when grandchildren are young, you're just establishing and developing this very important relationship. And part of that relationship is established because of the consistency of seeing one another. And when you can't do that, you've really pulled the rug out from the relationship.
Yeah. Can I ask how old Harper is?
She's very young. She's only 18 months, which makes it in some ways even harder. But the Harper in the book is a kind of a nondescript child who's under 5 probably. But this book actually applies to children all the way up to 4th grade because they don't understand it. And I've had little readers who are in the 2nd and 3rd grades who have said that they suddenly understand it a little bit better. A lot of times, I just want to say, Greg, we don't take the time to talk to children about what's happening. So this is a very big event in their lives, but has anybody actually sat them down and said, this is why you can't see your grandparents? We have a very serious illness that nobody knows how to treat. Nobody takes the time to do that. And in some ways, we devalue our children because we don't take the time. I think it's very important that they have a book like this so that they feel that they matter and they suddenly have a better understanding of very large events in the world that are affecting them in a unique way.
Right. And of course, that's probably a first for most young children that, I mean, something really important can happen and not necessarily directly affect them or their lives, at least in a way that about which they would be aware. But this is a case where something has happened out there in the world, and suddenly life for their own family and life for them has changed profoundly.
And some of them are not necessarily grandchildren. Some of them have parents who are doctors and nurses, and they can't come home because the coronavirus has forced them to live in a B&B or live in their car. So they don't see their own children for a very long time. Related to our point, Greg, I wanted to say that one thing that inspired me is I remember around the time I was thinking about this book, there was a country, and I think it was Finland, that decided to have a news conference for children. So they actually had experts come up and respond to the specific questions of a group of children, and they could ask all about the pandemic and what's happening and why is it happening. And those questions are very different from what you would hear from journalists on the big television or radio stations. Wow. So, you know, I thought that was a really interesting way to handle this. And that made me start to think, what can I do that would specifically address children's issues?
We're speaking with author Fern Schumer Chapman and talking right now about her latest book, which she has just written within the last few weeks during this COVID-19 crisis, titled Happy Harper Thursdays, A Grandmother's Love for Her Granddaughter During the Coronavirus. The title refers to her own granddaughter in real life, Harper, and the fact that their regular weekly meetings on Thursday obviously cannot happen right now because of this COVID-19 crisis in which through which all of us are living. One of the questions I was anxious to ask you, and from something you said earlier, I'm even more anxious to ask you now, is how did you weigh the possibilities or the various options when it came to describing the coronavirus, which I think you said you describe as kind of a tiny little bug or something or other.
A mini bug.
Ah, okay.
A mini bug.
Yes. But trying to think about how one describes this in a way that is honest and truthful and yet not overly frightening to a young reader. I mean, given the reality that we're talking about something that is frightening. And how did you see your role as author of this book in terms of how to handle that specific matter?
You know, I thought a lot about how I would have tried to explain this to my own children when I was a much younger mother. And I wanted it to be as clear as possible. So in the book, I say, a nasty bug has gotten in our way, making people sick in one town after another. You can't see it anywhere, but it's everywhere. The bug jumps from grandmothers to grandfathers, from moms to dads, from parents to kids. It makes them feel too hot, too achy, too tired. And right now, nobody knows how to stop it. So my reason for using those words was it's very basic and understandable. And of course, I go on to say that the only way to be safe is to never leave home so the bug can't find you. That's why we can't be together. So I think that I really brought the complicated issues down to a very basic level. And I think that young children can understand it. And I've gotten a lot of feedback, and a lot of the kids are saying that they really like the book because it's a very optimistic book, even though it's a very painful subject. Because, of course, Happy Harper and her grandmother will one day be reunited, but it'll take a little bit of time. And I think the lesson of the book is that we all have to be patient. And one of the funniest things that happened, Greg, in all this is for the beginning of the book, I selected the page, after every storm comes a rainbow. And coincidentally, that has become the mantra of this whole event. If you look it up online, you see that that's kind of the message of hope that many people are using. Now, I picked that long before this was even in use. So it's just a wild coincidence.
Ah, I like that. I like that a lot. And some of the artwork, which we'll talk about in just a little bit, reflects that as well. I'm looking at the beautiful back cover of the book, which has kind of the faint reflection of a rainbow. How about choosing words? You've already talked about the fact that one of the things you have to do when you're writing a children's book is you have to really make every single word count. It has to be, in a sense, a very lean style of writing. Beyond that, what kind of a challenge did it pose to you in terms of writing this in a way that would make sense to young readers, and especially when I presume you didn't have any youngsters, any young readers to kind of share this with to sort of test it out?
I wanted it to be very conversational. So the style of the book is me talking to my young granddaughter. And the other thing I wanted to do is to make sure that she would remember the Thursdays we spent together. So what are the things that we did? Well, we read books and we danced to old rock and roll songs. And, you know, she likes to dig in my purse. So we have all sorts of very specific routines. And I don't think they're all that much different from other grandparents' routines. We like to do the same things. So really the book tries to connect with the young child through those happy experiences that they would have from a beloved grandparent or beloved relative. So I was trying to make it specific to Harper, but also resonate in a larger way with other grandparents as well.
Let's talk about your collaborator on this book. And I want to reiterate that, if I remember correctly, this is your first children's picture book. I think you've written a couple of books that were at least intended for young readers. I don't recall now if any of your previous books we would really call exactly a children's book in the sense that this is a children's book. But certainly a very important element in this is the artwork of Phoebe Chandler Turner. Tell us about her and about your collaboration in shaping this book together.
Phoebe Chandler Turner is my next door neighbor. And after I wrote the words for Happy Harper Thursdays, I thought a couple of things. I thought, oh, this is great. I really like what I've done. However, they're going to lift the shelter in place restrictions before I even have a chance to get it out. So that was always the cloud that was hanging on the horizon for me. But then I thought, I can't illustrate this myself. I'm not an artist. I don't know anybody I could get who would be able to do this for me. And I was sort of frustrated because I had this wonderful, I thought this text that had great potential, but I didn't know what to do with it. And I thought, like I said, that I wouldn't have relevance after a certain point because the restrictions would be lifted. Well, unfortunately, and I guess great for the book, the restrictions have not been lifted. And sadly, we could be seeing more and more shelter in place times in upcoming years until we get a vaccine or some sort of medicine to treat this. So the book has relevance. But I took a walk one day when I was first working on this. And as I was walking up my driveway and thinking about who could I possibly get to illustrate the book, I remembered that I had seen some of Phoebe's work many years ago. She has not ever done a children's book. She is a graphic designer who really hasn't been working all that much in recent years. And I just came home and called her and said, how would you like to do something wild? And of course, because people are at home with not that much focus, as you pointed out, and not that much to do, she was game. And she created the illustrations, which honestly, I can't believe this is her first book because they are remarkable and they bring the story to life.
I agree. And I would never guess that she is someone who has not done this kind of thing specifically, that is illustrated with children in mind. So did you, in essence, hand her the text and then she came back with the drawings, or was there some kind of back and forth trading of ideas?
There was a little bit of trading of ideas. So for example, I wanted to make sure the grandmother and the granddaughter were in a lot of the illustrations together. And so that was one of the things that I encouraged her to do. But for the most part, Phoebe came up with it on her own. And she showed me her early versions of Harper. And Harper is a great character in life and in the book. Just full of a life force is what she is. And I think that comes through in the book. I'm just thrilled with what Phoebe did. I think she really did bring the love and the spirit of the relationship to the page.
And in case we didn't say that, she herself is a grandmother, so in a case, she is experiencing the same thing that you are, I assume.
Absolutely. And honestly, I put some comments about Happy Harper Thursdays up on my Facebook page, and so many people chimed in who are grandparents and struggling during this time. I really do think this is a largely unacknowledged group of people. And while we are facing such more severe situations, like worries about mortality and worries about catching this thing, the smaller issues, but nonetheless the ache, the chronic ache, is not being able to see those we love.
We're speaking with Fern Schumer Chapman, and we've been talking about her newest book called Happy Harper Thursdays, A Grandmother's Love for Her Granddaughter During the Coronavirus, a book that she has, needless to say, just written. And I'm kind of amazed that it can already be available, but this is already something people can order.
Well, it was a great distraction. And I should say something else here too. I was in a lot of pain about not seeing Harper. And so this was a unique way for me to feel close to Harper when I couldn't see her. So I was very driven to work on this project during those 6 weeks so that I could feel that connection with my granddaughter.
Very good. And it's good that this book is already something that people can order and take into their own lives and benefit from. And I'm glad we can draw attention to it. I would like to spend a few minutes returning to the story of you and your own mother, which you have already touched on in terms of kind of the connection that it has with this other story. And I'm thinking particularly for those who have not had the experience of reading your book, Motherland, or did not hear our previous conversation. So maybe you could just briefly sketch the situation that your grandmother, your mother found herself in terms of having to leave her home and not fully understanding exactly just why that had to occur, and kind of the ongoing ramifications of that hurt, which for the longest time she really probably did not begin to fully understand.
Right. Well, I think once I start describing all this, it'll become increasingly clear why I wrote Happy Harper Thursdays. My mother's life, and to some extent, derivatively, my life, have been defined by my mother's early separation from her own parents. In the 1930s, my grandparents and my mother, who lived in a very small town in Germany, they sensed the growing anti-Jewish hatred at the time when Hitler was in power. And my grandparents made the most painful choice any parent could face. And that is, they knew that they couldn't get the whole family out of Nazi Germany. And so they decided that they had to send their then 12-year-old daughter to America Africa all by herself. They had hoped that they would follow, but of course, sadly, that would not be the case. My mother was placed with an uncle and an aunt. The uncle was the blood relative and in Chicago. And the uncle very much wanted to take my mother in, but the aunt was far less enthusiastic. And so my mother, at the age of 12, without any family support, had to establish herself in a new country with a new language, really a new identity, and without any family support. This is the story of an unaccompanied minor before we even had that label. My mother was deeply traumatized, number one, by the early life immigration experience, and number two, by the placement in this rather unloving home. And the way she coped with all this is she never spoke of her own history. And she, of course, did eventually grow up. She actually became a nurse, got married to my father, who was a doctor, had children, and the way she managed her history was to never speak of her past. She had almost no relatives, so you can only imagine the curiosity that this built into me and, to some extent, my brother. Who was she? What happened in her early life that she won't talk about? Why doesn't she have any relatives to cross-reference her and to give me some understanding? The entire side of that family was like, it was dark. I had no sense of who they were.
And I'm trying to remember from our previous conversation if it was a matter of asking her from time to time and being told, no, I don't want to talk about that, or was, in a sense, the veil so thick that you would never even think of posing the question in the first place? I mean, did you ever, in those earlier years, ever even feel yourself comfortable enough to ask your mother about any of this?
Not really. I think that children very quickly sense what's off limits, and her history was clearly off limits. I do have a very specific memory when I was probably 8 years old. She was using nylon stockings to make plum jelly. She was using that as the netting to get the juice out. And I was watching her, and I sort of asked, what were you doing? And she said, I'm making jelly the way my mother once made jelly. And I remember thinking to myself, wait a minute, you had a mother? Now I'm really confused.
Because so there's never been a mention.
Right. So that kind of shows you how off limits the topic was.
Right. And of course, typically in a family, those kind of things would be referenced all the time. In fact, even in the typical family where for some reason there was unhappiness there, you would still know that somebody had a mother. But
right.
for a person like that to essentially never be spoken of is really something. I remember from Motherland, one of the observations you made that I found so fascinating was that your mother was an incredibly meticulous housekeeper. And that I don't know if you ever asked her about this, but I think it's maybe more likely that you surmise that one of the reasons, for instance, she had such a spotlessly clean floor was because that was the kind of thing over which she could maybe exert some level of control, and that those being almost fanatically immaculate housekeeper, that was one way for her to try to compensate for all of the other hurts in her life and all of the ways in which life had kind of spun on out of her direct control.
I actually think that that's a pretty typical response to trauma. When people experience something terrible, a huge loss in their lives, there's a tendency to direct themselves towards something they can control. So for example, when a boy might lose a father at a young age, he might throw himself into his schoolwork as a way that he can actually control that situation. And so it's a response. It's a response to anxiety. It's also a response to feeling like you have to have some control over something in this terribly disorganized and chaotic life.
So explain to our listeners, again, this is primarily for the benefit of those who've not had the pleasure of reading Motherland or hearing our previous conversation. Explain how, in a sense, the story changed very dramatically for your mother and for you and for your relationship.
Well, so much, I can't remember, Greg, where we actually left off the last time. So much has happened, and I'm going to bring you along on the trajectory. So my mother never spoke of her history, and I grew up, had two sons, had become pregnant with a third child. I was very much hoping for a daughter. I was talking about it all the time. And out of the blue, when I was six, probably 5 months pregnant, my mother comes to me and says, I want to go back to my town. Well, this town, I was so unfamiliar with her history that I couldn't even pronounce the name of the town. This town has only, when she was there, had 2,000 people and two Jewish families. So it was very small. When she asked me to go back, I was like, now? This is really not a convenient time. I was pregnant, but she said, yes, now. And I was so worried that if I didn't take this opportunity now, I wouldn't have it again. And so the basis for Motherland was the first few trips. And the first one was when I was 6 months pregnant. And when we finally got to her little town, she was flooded with memory and suddenly willing to share what had happened to her as a child. But the book is about many things. The book is about our trips, of course. It's about how the Germans received us, because in this little town, everyone had a sense of what they had or had not done during this very crucial time in history. And finally, the book is about a transformation in the relationship, because when my mother finally started to open up, it changed the dynamic between us. And we have had a much richer relationship as a result of the books. Now, let me tell you a little bit about what's happened. I wrote a second book, which is used in middle schools, called Is It Night or Day? And that book is about my mother's childhood immigration experience as an unaccompanied minor. It's read in a lot of schools because they have a lot of immigrant kids who are struggling with the very same issues my mother faced in 1938. How to become an American, how to assimilate into teenage culture, how to even learn the language. In that book, I profile the friendship my mother made with another young girl named Gerda Katz. The two were both unaccompanied minors. They became inseparable on the ship. And then once they got to New York and had to part again, they lost touch with each other. Well, that book is read in a lot of middle schools, and some students at Madison Junior High School read it and became curious what happened to Gerda Katz. And maybe they could reunite Edith and Gerda, 73 years after they last saw each other. Well, these kids were successful. And my mother and Gerda saw each other again, and it was featured on an Oprah show. And that book, which is called Like Finding My Twin, is actually a model for how students can do source learning projects. So that's kind of its own incredible part of the story. But then I've done other works, and one was in 2014, my mother and I were invited back to this little town for the installation of what's called Stolpersteine, which are plaques to remember the victims of the Holocaust. And they are installed in front of what was the former homes of the Jewish families. Wow. In this little town, my mother and I returned, and we saw the installation of the stones. Now, the reason these events are so important is because there are no funerals and no places of remembrance for the victims. And so these events actually serve as a kind of funeral and provide quite a bit of closure. I hesitate to use the word, but for my mother, or at least some peace. There are 70,000 stones installed in over 1,000 formerly Nazi-occupied cities. And this is all part of an artist activist project, which has been extraordinarily powerful and successful. And what happened in my mom's little town when we went is the Lutheran Church, and I capture all this in the book Stumbling on History, the Lutheran Church actually apologized to my mother for the fact that they did not step up and protect her at that time. Wow. So it's been a very emotional story. And finally, the other book that I've done is called Three Stars in the Night Sky. I learned about Gerda and her, the other unaccompanied minor, and her story. And remarkably, Gerda's family got out of Nazi Germany at about a very late moment. And they were rescued in a way by a program that nobody's heard about. It was organized by the dictator, Rafael Trujillo, who was the dictator of the Dominican Republic. And he had willingly taken in Jewish people, even though at that time, country after country would not accept Jews. And there were hundreds of thousands of Jewish refugees with no place to go. But he said he would take people. Why? Well, one thing is he had murdered 25,000 Haitians for the color of their skin, and he had a really bad global image. But secondly, and this is the bizarre part, he wanted to lighten his people's skin.
Wow.
So he had, yes, this is very bizarre. People who were actually persecuted for their religious beliefs in Europe were then prized for the color of their skin in the Dominican Republic. And he took in 600 families, and some of those families did intermarry. So that book about Gerda's family, which her part of her family was, her parents were saved through this program, is called Three Stars in the Night Sky. So I've had kind of a wild trajectory.
Yeah, but what a rich story that, in a sense, keeps on giving. With one extraordinary chapter after another. I'm so glad to know about all of that. And in the meantime, I want to make sure we remind our listeners about the latest book, which is so important for people to remember, again titled Happy Harper Thursdays, A Grandmother's Love for Her Granddaughter During the Coronavirus. One can go to Amazon.com, and I suspect other vendors, and it is available and is something that grandparents and grandchildren and lots of other people need to seek out and experience for themselves. And the talented woman responsible for it, Fern Schumer Chapman. Fern Schumer Chapman, it was wonderful to reconnect with you today. I'm so glad that we could have this conversation. And best wishes to you and to your whole family as we go forward from here.
Thank you, and thanks for the opportunity.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be speaking with three different art professors at Carthage College about the challenges involved in teaching things like sculpture and ceramic and painting and drawing via the internet in the online virtual format that has been necessitated by COVID-19 and the distancing which we have to do right now. I speak with Kimberly Green, Ryan Miller, and Jojen Van Winkle. And that conversation is airing tomorrow on The Morning Show. A little later in the week, you'll be hearing from some theater faculty from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside who are contending with the same kind of challenges. How does one teach, for instance, scenery painting or stage combat? We'll be finding out about all of that. Later in the week as well, we hear from Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, and Patrick Booth, who is the keynote speaker for Gateway's virtual commencement graduation ceremony, which is coming up this weekend. Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed at the moment, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. We remind you, as always, that The Morning Show can also be heard as a podcast and can be heard as a podcast 7 days a week. Be sure to subscribe to The Morning Show with Greg Berg via Spotify, Google Podcast,